Simon Sharma studied history at the University of Cambridge, where he was fellow and director of studies from 1966 to 1976. He was also fellow and tutor at Brasenose College, Oxford. From 1980 to 1993, he was Mellon Professor and Keenan Professor in the Humanities at Harvard University. Currently, he is Professor of Art History and History at Columbia University. He has received international renown for his works, which have been translated into 10 languages. Some of his major publications include The Embarrassment of Riches, An Interpretation of Dutch Culture in the Golden Age, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution, Landscape and Memory, Rembrandt's Eyes, and The History of Britain. In addition to these publications, he has been a writer and presenter for several television documentary series, including The Art of the Western World, Rembrandt, The Public Eye and Private Gaze, and The History of Britain. Among his many awards, he received the NCR Prize, a major British nonfiction prize, for his book Citizens. In 2001, he was made a Commander of the British Empire for the Queen's Birthday Honors. Far more significant about Simon Sharma than his positions, prizes, and awards, however, is the enormous impact he has had on the way we write about and study history. His wonderfully witty literary style transports readers to the towns, landscapes, and streets of the past, where one can almost hear the chatter and taste the foodstuffs of the era. In what he calls shameless eclecticism, he is able to integrate an examination of art, religion, politics, literature, economics, and society in a manner that delightfully resurrects the past, thus making it part of our present. He is the kind of scholarly voice that we attempt to emulate in our own study of civilization here at BYU. We turn the time now to Professor Sharma.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Reynolds, for that generous and kind introduction. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank the faculty, and I want to thank all of you, dear students, from tearing yourselves away. I should be thanking you from tearing yourselves away from much more important work, except I know you've got to be here. I thank you anyway for that. I once belonged to a university where the chairman of the history department used to pick up the telephone rather disconcertingly and simply say, "History speaking." And sometimes, actually, when I'm billed as the voice of history, I feel all sorts of dangers of hubris coming on me in that manner. But history can be a cruel joker. My dear late friend, the Russian poet Joseph Brodsky, wrote in one of the most beautiful and moving and worrying essays ever written about history, The Profile of Cleo, that when history arrives, she always, he says, takes you by surprise. And I reread that essay on the morning after the hideous mass murders of September the 11th, 2001, and ruminated darkly on just how right he had been. I suppose many of us in the humanities, whether we're doing art history or literature, often are asked by puzzled donors to our universities, what use is it? What good is it? And if we're truthful with ourselves, we ought to not just simply assume that what we do is ever intellectual business as usual. But in the aftermath of 9/11, I must say it was one of those moments when I thought to myself that history that's worth writing often comes to us with integrity, truth, and gripping importance at moments of crisis. It's not that history gives you a kind of recipe about how to fix a moment of danger and perplexity, but you can be sure that without history, without the perspective of reflecting on a lengthier period of time than today or this week's news editorial, you will be lost. Cicero told us that great cultures, great empires, great societies, which have no history, which develop the disastrous condition of shared amnesia, will forever remain in the condition of a child, not knowing whither we go because we would be ignorant always of whence we came. And that should really be a motto tacked to every working historian's wall, I believe. History, above all, is a corrective to the kind of short attention span, short shelf life, frantic zip-cut pace of the world, reflected supremely, I think, on television, with its impatience, really, of anything that goes beyond a soundbite or goes beyond a kind of guttural sound made by the likes of Ozzy Osbourne. I took my courage in my hands. I was daunting than this occasion, certainly at least as daunting as this occasion, was a speech I gave to the Harvard Phi Beta Kappa graduating class last year, which I thought I had to prepare for by looking at past Phi Beta Kappa orations. And to my horror, I'd seen they'd been given by the likes of Ralph Waldo Emerson, with whom it was hard to compete. Nonetheless, I charged ahead and called the speech. I thought, well, if you're talking about eloquence, I'm going to call it The Fate of Eloquence in the Age of Ozzy Osbourne. And the news about that is not particularly good. I have to also say that rereading Joseph Brodsky's beautiful essay made me think, well, history in its founding moments, history as written when it began in the Western tradition, written by Herodotus and Thucydides, came wearing not a happy face. It has always been, at the beginning, a cautionary art. It's always a corrective not just to frantic thoughtlessness, but also to unearned cheerfulness, unearned optimism. Thucydides, after all, was a protagonist in the Peloponnesian War. He was a general. In fact, he died before he could complete that extraordinary seminal work. Herodotus also, as someone who was not of Athens, but of the Greek world, he came from the larger Mediterranean islands. He in fact, wrote it in Ionic rather than Attic Greek, was also someone for whom the reason to actually begin to write history was to sound a cautionary note against overconfidence. Neither of them were the slightest bit, of course, apologetic about being a Greek, but in their different ways, they felt history's work was a work always of self-understanding, the illumination of the kind of animal we are through a true report of what we have done. In Herodotus' case, and those of you, I don't know, I'm sure many of you have read Herodotus' history, but it is, if you haven't, it is still a beautiful and gripping and often funny and extraordinary work of great poetic intensity and power. And Herodotus begins it absolutely shamelessly by saying, "I, Herodotus," you instantly are in the company of, as it were, the original television presenter and the best there's ever been. Herodotus, unlike the flintier, more austere Thucydides, is full not just of a riveting tale to tell, a cautionary tale to tell in the war of the Greeks and the Persians, but is also a shameless gossip. I often think about him as one of those people next to whom one sat, whether one likes it or not, on a shuttle airplane trip between New York and Washington, and who just starts talking unstoppably at you when you're wanting to read your Wall Street Journal, your Atlantic. And you think, oh God, where did I put my earplugs? And then gradually, the adorable, sweet music. Macaulay spoke about Herodotus's artful prose as the sweet babbling of a child, which is a bit unfair to Herodotus. Gradually, as you're sitting there thinking, oh, you know, where is my parachute? You realize that what you're being told is not only charming and engaging, but also rather true and surprising. That's the effect Herodotus has on you. He has that effect on you because Herodotus made huge efforts to understand the enemy. He wasn't simply content to stigmatize the Persians as barbarians. He made an enormous effort to understand their religion. Indeed, he travelled to Egypt as well as Persia in order to understand from the inside and so far as a Greek could what it was like to be in the skin of a Persian or an Egyptian, not just their history and their politics and their religion, but also their diet, their dress, their festivals, their family life. Thucydides, on the other hand, who, as you know, was rather critical of all this kind of gossipy sweetness of Herodotus, felt he had more, if you like, a political science assignment to ask right from the beginning, of history, not that it should be just a kind of memory scroll, but an investigation. The word for history, historia in Greek, means an inquiry. And for Thucydides, just as for the great narrators of the American Civil War, the Civil War of the Peloponnesians, the war between the Spartans and their allies and the Athenians, was the great slaughter, the great tragedy deep in the heart of Greek history, of Western civilization. It was, above all, a chastening corrective to assumptions of overconfidence. In the core curriculum requirements, in which Thucydides is, again, very beautiful as well as very intellectually powerful work is situated, almost invariably it's the funeral speech by Pericles, which is set as a perfect example of a political figure who attempts to sum up to those who may be about to die, and he, of course, sums it up over the dead bodies of those who have already made a sacrifice for their country, for freedom, for Athens, for their particular way of life. He tries to sort of give people a sense, those who are about to be sent in harm's way, of the moral reasons why they should be proud to be part of their particular political community and not just simply be an equivalent to another warring tribal state. And it is invariably a moving and important document. But all too often we overlook those parts which are much, much darker, still darker, in Thucydides' account. The exemplary coherence of the Athenian community simply disintegrates in terrified shock and self-interest when the plague strikes Athens, one of the most riveting pieces of historical narrative ever written. And at the very, towards the end of the Peloponnesian Wars, Thucydides, of course, gives us the great set piece of the two speeches before the ill-fated expedition to Syracuse gets going. The speech of the supremely confident Alcibiades and the much darker, pessimistic speech of a man who has been there on the front line, the general Nicias. And Thucydides leaves it to us, although he knows that we know that the expedition to Syracuse would come to a catastrophic end, leaves it to us to have the maturity and wisdom to decide for ourselves about exactly the validity of both the cautionary as well as the more aggressively confident remarks. Now, I think it's because so much of history was written not just in a cautionary temper, but I would say arrived in the center of the Western cultural bloodstream with a tragic expression on its face, that history has been a difficulty for America. In some sense, America was born through the rejection of history. Those feuds and bloodlettings were part of the old world's record. The founding fathers hoped to establish a society separate from the contamination of those atavistic struggles, precisely because it was going to be founded on the basis of a new kind of political wisdom. It took the catastrophic chastening of the Civil War to make people like, of course, Abraham Lincoln, and some of the earliest generations of great American historians like Henry Adams themselves wear a slightly more cautious demeanor. But for me, as a sort of working stiff in history, really, wanting above all to take history not just to exercise it not just in a university department, but in the elementary schools, the high schools, and out there in the great public arena of debate, I will just stop in a small digression by saying I was very lucky, as I said yesterday, that I was taught by professors at history who exemplified the dictum of the novelist E.M. Forster, what do they of history know who only know other historians? My professors told me that if you didn't take the civic vocation seriously, to take history into the centre of the cultural life of an entire community, you weren't really doing your job. And I've attempted in my halting, incompetent way to live up to that really serious challenge. Now, when one does take history out into the American cultural mainstream, the first thing that you collide with is the insuperable dinosaur-like object of the high school social studies textbook. If I were a dictator, and I know you're all going to make me one, right, by acclaim, the first thing I would do would abolish those hideous words social studies. Enough already. Social studies is a ghastly, furtive, shameful euphemism for subjects which should be proud to say what they are. History, the study of the past. Geography, the study of the world. Economics, the study of money, I suppose. Let's call them by what they are. Social studies. It's an extraordinarily dispiriting fact. That I was told by somebody that actually, yesterday, that a poll of high school students indicated that their least favourite subject was history. Worse than math! This is what we've come to. This is a ghastly thing. And no wonder, with these sort of miserable, spine-cracking objects of instant tedium, really, hauled in your backpack every day, of course it's the most hated subject. But there is hope. This is a devotional meeting, after all. You know, this is an act of faith. There is hope for history. And the hope is this. The hope is this, that actually once you get over school history, once you get into your university classrooms, and above all, actually, you know, there has to be hope for a culture which decided that David McCulloch's biography of John Adams was beach reading. Which it was, you know, not so long ago. The disparity between the sort of history that's thrust at you, endlessly long, extended riffs on the New York Times op-ed page, sort of digests of worthiness that you get in the social studies textbooks, is belied utterly by the possibilities of what I call the new history. History of which television is a part. We're at the dawning of an age when everybody can have the archive on their own laptop. If any of you don't know just how exciting this new moment is and don't happen to know this website, try hitting, it's called Valley of the Shadow, an absolutely brilliant electrifying site developed at the University of Virginia, which deals with the history of two particular counties, one in Pennsylvania and one in Virginia. And this is a kind of history website which is available for elementary school children, grannies, graduate students, faculty, everybody has something to learn, and in which they can actually constitute a community of their shared work. It's really an exemplary thing. So television, I went around for a long time ranting and raving about how television should be doing this, and of course in the great work of Ken Burns and Rick Burns, the PBS documentaries, it has done extraordinarily great work to make this gap a little less serious. But I was very aware when I started the history of Britain that of Neil Postman's chilling dictum that serious television is a contradiction in terms, kind of our contemporary oxymoron. The first duty, it did seem to me, of television really was to absolutely hold the viewer in thrall. But I really went back again to another great hero of the craft of mine, Lord Macaulay, who said that history was... he always talked about history rather wonderfully as half philosophy and half poetry, half the work of the imagination and half the work of reason. It should be spellbindingly the work of the imagination. You should feel your ancestors in time rushing through your own body when you read it and when you see it. At the same time, you have to ask questions. It can't just be entertainment, even entertainment of the very highest caliber. Macaulay said that history, in order to really register its force, must be burnt into the imagination before it can be received by the reason. I thought, oh, well, yes, we'll try that. And what we did was indeed to try that. I mean, at the beginning of our programs, 15-part programs, very daunting, there was no history of the kind in which I'm just about to show you a few clips on the BBC when we started. It was thought that presenter-led is the phrase. In other words, having a real author who spoke the lines he'd written, as great as the Burns Brothers and David Grudin's documentaries are, generally what happens, of course, is someone else writes a script and someone is a so-called host. The sort of detachment between the person who is really writing the great narration and those who are presenting it on television. I wanted that distinction to be abolished, for better or worse. When I finally had the temerity to say, yes, I do this, after being a bit frightened of doing it for many, many years, I thought, I warned the producer, I'm going to be just an incredibly major pest. I don't want to speak anybody else's lines. I want to be the interlocutor between the viewer and the past. It's got to be me, shamelessly me, a subjective interpretation for better and worse. I remembered, actually, my dad took me when I was a kid to see, I was 8 years old, all of 8 years old, see Henry V, Shakespeare's Henry V, played by the then unknown actor Richard Burton. We sat in the kind of fourth row and I smelt what I thought was definitely the aroma of the 15th century, or the 16th century. It was, in fact, the rather moth-eaten costumes of the Old Vic Theatre Company and the heavy grease paint. But I remember before Burton came on, the chorus in that extraordinary, you could all stand up and chant it, you all know it, don't you? Oh, for a muse of fire that will ascend the very heaven of invention. The job of Shakespeare's chorus is to say, you know I'm just this schmo in the street, really. I'm not actually some sort of prince, and my actors are just a company of actors. But you will, in the next 2 hours, you will see them as kings and warriors. Instead of our miserable wooden vaulting horses, you will see horses neighing in the fields before Agincourt. And this sort of magic, not that I purport remotely to deliver Shakespeare, even on BBC television, nonetheless, I wanted to have that kind of poetic connection. But I also wanted, as it were, that none of this should simply be sorcery, electronic sorcery. I wanted it to be debate. I wanted it to be provocative. So I'm going to show you clips of the four things which I hoped would actually constitute this particular, try and rise to this particular daunting challenge. And they exemplify four things. The first one is that Western history is, above all, the history we stretch your imagination to think of an alternative outcome. Tyrannies, always feed you the history which are overdetermined. Say, we are here, we Hitler, we Stalin, we whoever. History was always bound to arrive at me, at us, at our system and our ideology. The freedom of Western history is to be able to imagine way things might have turned out. The first clip I'm going to show you is an example of an alternative outcome. In the film about the Reformation, we know that the Catholic Church was not actually on its knees at the point in which Henry VIII instituted from above the Protestant Reformation. The Catholic Church was alive and well in every possible way you can imagine. And more remarkably still, when you walk around an English church these days, you will mostly be won over by the kind of purity and grace and simplicity of its greyish, whitish masonry, the clarity of the windows. Occasionally there'll be a stained glass window. English churches before the Reformation looked as more as if they were in Naples. They were an extraordinary, effulgent glory of colour. And we wanted to use television to try and bring back the Catholic Church world that might have been. And here's one way we did it. Can we roll the first clip? Thank you. That's Holy Trinity Church in Long Melford, and everything you saw in that computer pane box was actually based on the document. That particular church, the sexton was a man called Roger Martin, and at the point, who was an unrepentant Catholic, all right into the reign of Queen Elizabeth, at the point where he knew that the Catholic Church was not coming back, the Protestant Reformation was here to stay, he wrote a document, kind of diary down, detailing for secret, for fugitive Catholics, exactly what the glory of Long Melford had been like. You remember, the first thing that the Protestant Reformation did was destroy all that paint as idolatrous, smash the stained glass windows, take down the rood screen, melt down the holy vessels and sculptures at the back of the altar. So we thought we would bring that world, and we never varied by an inch from the truth of the document. And I say this because, actually, not out of a sense of ingratitude, but one of the television series, you may have caught it, called Freedom, History of Us. It's an absolutely excellent scheme based on a very good series of books by Joy Hakim. But when I saw the first, it has Katie Couric as a narrator. This is a classic instance of a celebrity reading someone else's lines. It has more great celebs like Tom Hanks and so on reading the parts, voices over. But one thing it does do is actually play fast and loose with the truth. Why? Because it felt ultimately that its television history had to be smiley face, had to be an act of consolation, had to dodge the bullets. So to my dismay, in the first program, which was about, of course, the American Revolution, in order to give us a fake sense of E Pluribus Unum, the remark was made that 5,000 black Americans had fought on the Patriot side. And I had been leaping out of my seat with rage, because not only was it not true, I'd be amazed to know the document on which that was based, at most about 300-400, at most, possibly may have fought for the Patriots. The truth is, of course, that very large numbers of blacks fought for the British. My lot. If you were a slave, it wouldn't have escaped your attention that Lord Dunmore in 1775 said, if you can make it to the British lines, we will emancipate you. And it's estimated that between 40 and 60,000 slaves in the South did exactly that. Were they treated wonderfully by the British? In large number, not. But many of them were indeed given their freedom. At the end of the Revolutionary War, 5,000 of these freed slaves, including black redcoats, of which there were thousands rather than hundreds, were asked to be returned by George Washington to their masters, and one of the non-cynical British commanders said, push off, basically, they're coming with us, they're free already. Went to Canada, and then many of them to Sierra Leone. It's a story, but my goodness, wouldn't it be awkward in Freedom, a History of Us, to make the point that actually the declaration that an independent United States delayed the abolition of slavery for these people by 30 years? Too late to hope that they would have remained British, I guess, but since I am a commander of the British Empire, if Utah feels like applying for readmission, I'll see what I can do. The second clips are about immediacy. History will not work. Truthful history will not work unless you have a sense of being there. And to be there, I think we did feel we needed some sense not just of going to paintings and not just going to documents, but also in some sense actually finding a way, without looking like bad costume drama, to put you absolutely on the spot, to sort of fire the fuse which brings your generation to feel as if you are part of the events that unfold before you. And when we did the execution of Charles I, when we cut off our king's head, we thought, well, I knew what I didn't want to happen was a rather tacky shot of someone who looked as though he was a refugee from the World Wrestling Federation with a big axe going, you know, thud and lots of tomato ketchup. I thought, no, 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 no. Not going to have that. So I thought much better would actually be because a sense of what it was like. A big crowd were more or less forced to watch the execution of the king on January 31st, 1649. Let's actually look at their eyes of those people. And partly because the program, that particular program, program number 9, was about looking. It was about the journey that Britain made from spiritual illumination, something which fired the likes of Oliver Cromwell, to the post-Newtonian sense of looking as almost a mechanical optical exercise. So we began with a moment of looking. And then what we did was thinking, if they were frightened, why were they frightened? The answer is because they wondered, even if they had been against the monarchy, who was going to take care of them. So we used animation for that. Then they're both very short clips, and I'm going to run them together. The second clip is also a now you are here moment. And it's a moment in the life of the first great British feminist, Mary Wollstonecraft, who in a great flight of revolutionary enthusiasm goes to Paris because she thinks that the French Revolution is going to deliver her kind of liberty. She's sorely disillusioned. And much of the beauty of history is the ability to connect private life with public life. And Mary Wollstonecraft, who writes the first great feminist treatise, who was a terrific kind of barricade-storming revolutionary, has a moment where she confesses to wishing she'd brought the cat with her to Paris. And let's run these next two clips. You'll see what I mean.
On January the 30th, 1649, the English killed their king. It had happened before, of course, all those Edwards and Richards violently done in by their own subjects. But this was different. Now the British monarchy itself had been exterminated. Now there was just the people and its parliament, the keepers of the liberties of England. But what was the point of freedom when you were frightened? What the people really wanted to know was, who would keep them safe? Who would stop the soldiers from burning and pillaging, allow people to sleep quietly in their beds? Who would protect them from the wars of religion and politics which seemed to go on and on and on? Would it be Parliament, or would it be a great general like Oliver Cromwell? It doesn't matter, said the hard-headed philosopher Thomas Hobbes, a royalist who'd come back to Cromwell's England. What the country needs is a strong ruler who embodies all the people. Whatever or whoever can save the country from anarchy, whatever can save you from yourselves. Never mind about what's right or wrong. Put yourself in the hands of the power that protects, the all-powerful Leviathan. As the arrests and executions started to speed up, Mary's natural exuberance began to cool. She sat in her room, scared and despondent, writing to Joseph Johnson.
I have seen eyes glare through a glass door opposite me, and bloody hands shook at me. I wish I had even kept the cat with me, as I want to see something alive. Death in so many frightful shapes has taken hold of my fancy. I'm going to bed, and for the first time in my life, I cannot put out the candle.
Those are, again, using toys, the contemporary 18th century toys from the Musée de Carnavalet, the Museum of the Revolution in France, much more effective, we thought. Sometimes less is more in that way. The lot of extras, you know, kind of waving sort of spears and things like that. The Thomas Hobbes moment, truly chilling moment, of course, do not worry about what's right and wrong, just worry about what works. That is, of course, in some sense, an extremely sort of creepy phenomenon that historians have to deal with. But history has to be moral engagement, or else it's a kind of soulless automaton. I'm not one of those historians who believe that you really have to maximize your dispassion. Certainly you shouldn't... disguise your prejudices and your biases, but nor should you disguise your own moral engagement in what you do. Television, too, when you have a tough truth, tell the tough truth. And this third clip is going to be an example of fairly brutal self-criticism. You'll see at the end of the clip, we're also using images. It's about the British Raj, it's about British India, a source of much breastbeating, but also a source of fairly severe and serious and intense self-examination. And we use the photographs that were taken by contemporaries of British India. You'll see one set of photographs which were taken, in some sense, out of a spirit of cheerful self-congratulation that modern Britain could coexist with old India. And at the very end, you'll see two entirely different kinds of photographs. They're photographs which we've all become horrifyingly familiar. And they were taken, in the first place, by the first generation of missionaries with Kodak portable cameras. Roll the next clip, please.
Now what India needed was an extravaganza to celebrate her new dominion. And who better to organise one than the noble, though irredeemably bad, poet, the Earl of Lytton. Lytton's India would be a new old India, a combination of tigers and peddlers, holy men and native princes, bejeweled, feudal and loyal. And the Queen Empress promised to protect the ancient usages and customs of India. The bond would be sealed at a Durbar, a great assembly, camped on the most sacred site of the Raj, Delhi Ridge, where the British had precariously held out during the mutiny, and which, along with Lucknow, had become a place of pilgrimage in the 20 years since. Spectacle would wipe out the memory of slaughter. On New Year's Day, 1877, thousands watched Lytton step onto a dais, its banners designed by Rudyard Kipling's father, and receive, on behalf of the Empress, the homage of 300 Indian noblemen, the Nizams and the Gaikwars and the Maharajas. The show had to be sufficiently over the top if it was to impress them with the stupendous invincibility of the Raj. As Lytton put it,
"The further east you go, the greater becomes the importance of a bit of bunting."
The banquet, the most expensive in British history, went on for a week. During that week, thousands of the Queen Empress's subjects in Madras and Mysore starved to death. No reason, Lytton thought, to let it spoil the party.
There are literally hundreds of those terrifying pictures of the Indian famine in the British India collection. And we thought to ourselves, is this really too hard, you know, for people who essentially tune into us on 8 o'clock on a Sunday evening to watch this? But it seemed to us absolutely a moment of inescapable obligation. I don't want to sound sanctimonious about that, that they should see that this was part of the British experience of ruling India, as well as the moment of self-glorification. But history isn't all about, you know, brutal self-cross-examination. It should also, if it has to lament what should be lamented, it ought also to honour and celebrate what should be celebrated, which is the last clip. The last programme, the 20th century programme, could not escape the huge figure and shouldn't have escaped the huge figure of Winston Churchill, although I pair him with George Orwell in the last programme, because in some sense, the two of them were utterly opposite extremes. George Orwell, the shabby, genteel socialist, against Churchill, the aristocratic, ultra-conservative patriot. But during the Second World War, they do rather extraordinarily, as you'll see, come together. And for me, the importance of both Orwell and Churchill was that they gave me a chance to meditate on history itself. Both of them used history not just as a form of academic training or a form of literary recreation, but it went right through to their sense of what it meant to be British at a moment of crisis. And I'm going to show you a clip about Churchill in a moment of crisis, and I just want you to also notice that we debated long and hard how to render Churchill's speeches. Do we do it with huge shots of him? And in the end we thought, again honouring our Greek ancestors, just the simple poetry of ruins, we set his speech against almost the nothingness of a World War II airstrip. We had to look very hard to find an airfield which genuinely dated from the 1940s with the right period control tower. And the thing about ruins is they both make you feel sad and also make you feel in the grass that comes through the now deserted runways that from ruin, from melancholy, always comes the positive expression of the new life of the next generation, which is you. So I'll have one sentence only to say after this last clip.
In his memoirs, Churchill never really owned up to just how close a shave this whole episode had been. And yet it was his refusal to accept the Nazi conquest of Europe that made the difference between surrender and survival. All the qualities which generally made him so impossible, his pig-headed obstinacy, his low boiling point, his romantic belief in British history, were now, in the black days of May, exactly what the country needed. In the days ahead, Churchill learned that against all predictions, 250,000 British troops had been evacuated from Dunkirk in 1,000 little ships. The core of the army that would return almost exactly 4 years later. It was his speech, broadcast to the country a few days later in June 1940, which was, as one MP said, worth 1,000 guns and the speeches of 1,000 years.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
This kind of indefatigable defiance was why George Orwell, for all his mistrust of Churchill's conservatism, was so relieved that at last Britain had a leader who realised, as he wrote, that wars were won by fighting.
Well, all that President Bush has to do tonight is sound sort of like that. Thank you very much.